You all know why I'm here, not an order. And I would not try to convince you of the worthiness of our cause. I'm a soldier, and we are at war.
We seem to never learn, here we go again. They rallied up the troops, God forgive the sin. Hidden agendas, can't we fight for truth? No, then there be no need to fight. Love isn't fatal, there's no fatalities. Hate supports US principalities. In this separation, we all suffer. We need to be in love with each other. This isn't training, actual invading. Depleted uranium is raining. Iraq, just know we don't have Bush's back. With a vicious attack, crossing borders with might. On foot catching flight. For hypocrisy, I will not fight. The Most High loves I, the word won't die. Even after all the times it's been revised. I've been shot by Charlton Heston, and he even autographed the weapon. The bullet was lodged in my left shin. I asked the doctor, and she kept it in.
The stress of waiting for the tension of battle, readying to make war, making peace with their God.
Baptize you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Before their baptism of fire.
Hello everybody, this is So Real from TruthLoveFreedom.org, and we are doing another broadcast here on Truth Radio. I'm running solo tonight. I just wanted to let everybody know that. Once again, Justin was not able to make it, but he will be back again next week, and we'll continue with him on other topics. Tonight's topic is a continuation of a podcast, the last podcast I did before I started doing this radio thing on Truth Radio, and it is about Zbigniew Brzezinski. He's one of my favorite people, as I said before on my previous podcast, and I'm saying that sarcastically because there's a lot of things about this guy that I can say that I severely hate. No, I don't hate. The reality is that he's coming from a position that I totally disagree with, and I think most citizens, if they were aware of what's going on in our government today, would be extremely against and would be active in participating to stop it. And conveniently for them, they are able to keep a degree of secrecy about their activities, which is another big issue that I have with them. So I'm going to go into, well, the last time I did this, this topic, we talked about his book, The Grand Chessboard. And if the name of the title of the book doesn't tell you much, you know, it should, because this is he's a person who deals in foreign policy. He was the national security advisor to Carter, worked under many administrations. He has a lot of clout. He's actually one of the founding members of the Trilateral Commission, which is, you know, basically a puppet organization for the Rockefellers. And he is basically our what we consider to be our foreign policy guru of this country. And he's written many, many books. He teaches at universities. He's worked in multiple governments and institutions for several years now. And he is one of the very first people that started basically, I would call it preaching, the idea that we need to have intervention in the Middle East if America is going to maintain its dominance over the world. And in the Grand Chessboard, you know, the Grand Chessboard, he looks at the world literally like a grand chessboard. And his idea behind the book is to try to predict what's going to happen in the future, and he did a pretty good job of it, I must say. And I think that for people who don't know who he is, to say that he has an influence on what's going on in our country today and with our foreign policy is a vast understatement. I would even present to you the possibility that he may very well be one of the most influential figures and one of the most quoted people in reference to why we're having an involvement in the Middle East. Now, he kind of dropped out of the arena or the limelight for a while until his recent book came out, which is very critical of George Bush, which of course is a popular position to have these days. And so now he's back in the spotlight. He was getting a lot of interviews, and I find it very ironic that this gentleman was marching through the country, you know, basically, you know, reaping the benefits of a book written on a subject that's very popular, when he's one of the founding members or the founding philosophies about in the Middle Eastern intervention. He would say that he had a different intention in mind but I'll leave that decision to you, because I'm going to read from his book, and this is how I am. I'm basically going to teach you as much as I can, because I'm not interested in just telling you what I believe. I am. That's part of what I'm doing, but mostly I want you to hear why I believe it, and then I want you to make a decision for yourself as to whether or not I'm correct. And if I'm not, like I say, always say this, please come share it with me. I don't want to be in error. So if you have another, you know, view about what things are what's going on in the world, by all means, come share it with me, and maybe we'll get to the bottom of what's actually happening. But I can say one thing for certain is that what most people believe to be happening in a government and in, as far as agendas are concerned today, are completely false. So, that being said, let me just jump into a few things here. And of course, I'm not going to go back over everything I did on my podcast. So I do encourage you to go to my website, truthlovefreedom.org. We have a podcast section. If you look at the categories on the right, you'll see the podcast section. You can play right off of the website. You don't have to download it unless you want to. We're on iTunes. We're on various. We have RSS feeds set up, and we're all over the internet as far as podcast sites. And I'm intending to make this available for download via podcast. If everything goes as planned, I'm hoping that tonight I'm a little bit clearer in what I'm saying, and it's not going to be so distorted. The last couple times have been pretty bad, mostly because I had some errors in the way I hooked up my equipment. So let's talk about another issue. I had mentioned on the podcast that Zbigniew Brzezinski is an interesting person to talk about, not only in terms of foreign policy, especially involved in the Middle East, or what he refers to as Eurasia, but also in terms of his connection to current events. For example, the Mujahideen. The CIA aided the Mujahideen during the early 1980s. And the idea, I guess, from what I understand, was that the Mujahideen was being armed and trained by the CIA to push back the Soviet influence in the Middle East, which was a long-term plan that's actually expressed in the Grand Chessboard. If you read it, he basically goes on to explain why there's a continuation of taking certain powers and trying to not only eliminate them as a potential threat, not even a threat, but a potential threat to the United States, but also pushing their back their sphere of influence so that we can continue to push our sphere of influence over in that region further. And what I find really interesting, and I hope you do too, is that when you're dealing in the topic of, say, Iran and Iraq, you know, we went into Iraq for whatever you want to believe, the reasons being. I expressed that in my last podcast. Actually, that was what the whole topic of Zbigniew Brzezinski was about. My podcast is called What is the War For? Because a lot of people have opinions about what the war is for, and usually it's like oil and things of that sort, and that's partially true. But mostly it was to get a permanent presence on that continent, closer to the Middle East, or, you know, directly in the Middle East if possible, to push out any potential conflict of interest. By us being there, automatically we have an unexpressed interest in the area, whether or not it's there or not. Just us being there militarily implies that the forces like China need to back off, that it's our turf, so to speak. And, you know, the reason why this is so interesting, and it's even more funny when I listen, I mean, it's not funny, I shouldn't say that, I say these things ironically, I'm being facetious, I'm not really believing that it's funny. It angers me deeply to watch him parade around and get praise from people every time he makes criticisms of Bush and what he's done in the Middle East, when I know from reading his works that he's more responsible for what's going on in the Middle East today than Bush could ever imagine. I mean, Bush is kind of more like less like a puppet president as far as I'm concerned. He's not smart enough to set policy, but he's definitely carrying it out, and he's doing what he's told to do. But when it comes down to why we're going there and why that's part of the agenda, the fingers point to Zbigniew Brzezinski. Not just him, but certainly he had his influence. So when he was President Carter's national security advisor, he did an interview with a French publication, and I don't know French, so forgive me, Les Nouvelles Observateurs. And This was January 15th through 21st issue of 1998 on page 76. There were two editions of this. There was a version of this article put into the U.S. Library of Congress, but believe it or not, the Zbigniew Brzezinski interview was missing. It was not part of that publication that was entered in there. Surprise, surprise. But he was questioned, and he got into it. I'm basically going to read this for you because I want you to understand his role. Question. The former director of CIA, Robert Gates, stated in his memoirs from the shadows that American intelligence services began to aid the Mujahideen in Afghanistan 6 months before Soviet intervention. In this period, you were a national security advisor to President Carter. You therefore played a role in this affair. Is that correct? Now, okay, let me stop there. Let me just fill in a little forward stuff. Basically, our position was that the invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviets is what prompted our CIA intervention in the area. You know, of course, because we're the people who, you know, set free nations, right? We're the ones that go into a country and we free them. And we aid those who are being oppressed, right? Okay, well, there's a problem there because, you know, it's part of history that we were involved 6 months prior to the invasion. So that's what this whole interview is about. Brzezinski replies, yes, according to the official version of history, CIA aid to the Mujahideen began during 1980, that is to say, after the Soviet army invaded Afghanistan, the 24th of December, 1979. But the reality, secretly guarded until now, is completely otherwise. Indeed, it was July 3rd, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. And that very day, I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention. Okay? So it was in his opinion that the Soviets would intervene because of our aid to the Mujahideen, not the other way around. That's important to realize. He questioned, despite this risk, you were an advocate of this covert action, but perhaps you yourself desired this Soviet entry into war and looked to provoke it? Brzezinski, it isn't quite that. We didn't push the Russians to intervene, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would. Question. When the Soviets justified their intervention by asserting that they intended to fight against a secret involvement of the United States in Afghanistan, people didn't believe them. However, there was a basis of truth. You don't regret anything today? Brzezinski, regret what? The secret operation was an excellent idea. It had the effect of drawing the Russians into the Afghan trap, and you want me to regret it? The day of the Soviets officially crossed the border, I wrote to President Carter, we now have the opportunity of giving the USSR its Vietnam War. Indeed, for almost 10 years, Moscow had to carry on a war unsupportable by the government, a conflict that brought about the demoralization and finally the breakup of the Soviet Empire. Well, there you have it. I mean, so there you go. We had intervention there. We basically provoked that war knowingly that we would, by being involved, we would provoke the Soviets to come in. The Soviets basically said it. They were denied to be the truth. And voila, we're in war. Not only that, we were responsible, not us, but, you know, our leaders, specifically Brzezinski, was responsible for bringing to power or helping to increase the influence of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who eventually became the Al-Qaeda, who now we are at war against. Ponder that for a second. It's funny because multiple times throughout history, I can almost prove without a doubt that we are responsible for the creation of what we consider to be our own demons. Like, we help them and then they rise to power and we go to war against them. How convenient. What a coincidence, huh? Question. And neither do you regret having supported the Islamic fundamentalism, having given arms and advice to future terrorists? Brzezinski replies, What is most important to the history of the world? The Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire? Some stirred up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War? Question. Some stirred up Muslims, but it has been said and repeated, Islamic fundamentalism represents a world menace today. Brzezinski replies, nonsense. It is said that the West had a global policy in regard to Islam. That is stupid. There isn't a global Islam. Look at Islam in a rational manner and without demagoguery or emotion. It is the leading religion of the world with 1.5 billion followers. But what is there in common among Saudi Arabian fundamentalism, moderate Morocco, Pakistani militarism, Egyptian pro-Western or Central Asian secularism? Nothing more than what unites the Christian countries. Voila. So here he is marching around. This is a guy who was responsible for funding. Oh, actually, we're going to go to commercial break and I'll continue when we get back.
If you were aware in the 1980s of the stress the world is in, you would probably have known about the meeting at Iron Mountain, the plan for tyranny, the meeting there of an elite group of people who laid out a blueprint for the kind of things we're experiencing today. There was, at that time, a VHS video produced called Iron Mountain. And I have a copy of it. I've had it for years. I've converted that to DVD, and I'd be glad to send you a copy of it. It's a little more than 2 hours long, and it is instructive. Ask for Iron Mountain when you write to Truth Radio, P.O. Box 344, Nipomo, California, zip code 93444. That's the DVD, Iron Mountain, when you write P.O. Box 344, Nipomo, California, 93444. Our policy? We give, you give. We live in the most remarkable times when we could be thousands of miles separated and still feel very close to each other. And that's the case with our advertiser, Michael Dees, who operates Mammoth Automotive in Lowell, Indiana. There at Lowell's premier auto repair shop, Michael will be able to meet all your needs if you are near enough to drive in there to find him. But if you have common interest with this fellow who really knows cars and says, if I can't fix it, it ain't broke, well, go to his website. It's madnessautomotive.com, and there you will find a link to Truth Radio. Goes naturally right into the flow of the text of his very well put together website. If it's a car, he can fix it. And so if you're traveling through, put him on your list. He's there in Lowell, Indiana, at 279 West Meadow Place. Madness Automotive, 279 West Meadow Place, Lowell, Indiana.
Okay, and we're back. So, if that doesn't thoroughly anger you, I think there's something wrong here. Because that when a person is deceiving the population of our country, putting us in danger, giving rise to fundamental Islam terrorists by training them on how to actually be terrorists in order to go to war with a government that had not provoked us, that they saw as a threat, and then to not feel like it was a bad idea considering the current circumstances. I mean, there's a lot to question there, especially about the role of government and fundamental aspects about what are, you know, our constitution and things of that sort. And if you didn't listen to the podcast I did about the Grand Chessboard, you should. If you've heard that, you're thoroughly outraged already. I mean, just reading that book, it's a tough read, and not getting red in the face, because the degree of elitism it's almost unbearable at times. And there's going to be no exception to this book, Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. This book was published originally in 1970. It's an old book. Actually, it's funny because I bought this book about a year ago. It was only worth about $30, and for some reason today it's worth around $250. Unbelievable. $250, that is. And the stuff that's said in here, I mean, where the Grand Chess Board was more or less a direct reference to our intervention in Eurasia in securing our power, as you know, he was involved in foreign policy, so that would naturally be something that he would be interested in. This book is a little bit more abstract. This is more a generalization. This is like, okay, the world is changing. We're going into a era of technology, and he is talking not about what could happen, which is like the Grand Chess Board, which he did also talk about what he thought should occur as well. I mean, it was not just a little bit of an analysis about what to predict. It was also how to deal with the predictions if they come true. This book deals more or less specifically with his ideas about a future society and the fact that these changes are about to occur and, you know, definitely what we should be doing about those changes. So I'm just going to go through. And, of course, I'm not going to read the whole book, especially during a single radio show. My goal is not to just read you stories. I mean, read you books. I want to provoke your interest to go read it yourself. There's a wonderful website. Actually, there's a gentleman I got in touch with recently. He's been going through and taking all the works that he has about the New World Order and the coming global government and scanning them and entering them into this website called scribd.com. That's S-C-R-I-B-D.com. Go there and type in a title from any book. I think his name is MKVA2000 or something like that. If you come across them, look at all the stuff he's uploaded. There's other people doing it as well. And you can go and read this book for free there. I mean, it's right online. You can confirm my quotes, and I encourage you to do so. Don't believe what I say. I mean, by all means, if anybody's going to encourage you not to believe somebody, it's me. Don't believe me. Go do the research for yourself, and you will see that these things are actually happening, as unbelievable as they can seem. So let me get into this book a little bit. I'm just going to read little quotes throughout the book and hopefully provoke your interest to actually take the time to read it. And I'm going to just skip around. Now, let me start real quick talking about his acknowledgments. And I always do this. Whenever I read a book about somebody who's a political figure and I want to investigate, I always go through and look at everything, the foreword, what they're saying, if they're quoting anything, who they're quoting, who they are, who they're affiliated with, everything about it. And it's really interesting, you know. He thinks his professors, one professor is Samuel P. Huntington, who is an interesting fellow. I'm not going to dedicate a whole session to him in the future, but I'm going to go through, I'm going to have a show where I go through and talk about the various people who are involved in our educational system, on our high universities. And I'm not talking about just your typical university. I'm talking about your Harvard, your Yales, and so on. Who these educators are, what they believe, what they're quoted as saying. So you can see there are colleges that our politicians are coming through in order to come into positions of power are almost completely in alliance with this agenda. There is no dissenting voices among these these so-called institutions of higher learning. So almost everybody who comes through there and has these teachers comes out with the same perspective. And that's definitely true of two of the professors that he quotes, one Samuel P. Huntington and one Albert Mavrinac, who is now actually deceased. And there is a Mavrinac award given out by the Phi Beta Kappa Society. That's a pretty substantial group there. Jeb Bush, the President Bush's brother, went to that university, the Rockefeller. Let's see here. I mean, they branch over many universities. So they're Henry Kissinger was a member of this society. And the list goes on and on. I'm not going to go through all this. I don't really have time for it right now. But I just thought it would be interesting to bring up because, Elu Root. It just goes on and on. These are all – many of these people are people who went on to positions of power to and continue to encourage influence and push for a global government, which is coming true today. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing this show, to try to prove that to you. So let me go into some quotes. I'm just going to skip around, and I'm not going to really tell you where I'm skipping. I might stop between them to comment, but you're going to have to actually read it if you're interested. The newly enfranchised masses are organized in the industrial society by trade unions and political parties, and unified by relatively simple and somewhat ideological programs. Moreover, political attitudes are influenced by appeals to nationalist sentiments communicated through the massively increase of newspaper employing naturally the reader's national language. In the technotronic society, the trend seems to be toward aggregating the individual support of millions of unorganized citizens who are easily within the reach of a magnetic and attractive personalities, and effectively exploiting the latest communication techniques to manipulate emotions and control reason. Reliance on television and hence the tendency to replace language with imagery, which is international rather than national, and to include war coverage or scenes of hunger in places as distant as, for example, India, creates a somewhat more cosmopolitan, though highly impressionistic, involvement in global affairs. Okay, and this is part of a steps process here to getting us to think more globally through forms of manipulation. Their nationalism is still a radical changing force, creatively mobilizing community feelings, but also prompting ethnic exclusiveness and conflicts. Yet it is generally true, as the author of a suggested paper notes, that, quote, the vision and objectives of society have changed. Today, a new concept of man and his world is challenging the concepts of the Renaissance, which have guided man's behavior for the past 500 years. Unquote. The nation-state, as a fundamental unit of man's organized life, has ceased to be a principal creative force. International banks and multinational corporations are acting and planning in terms that are far in advance of the political concepts of the nation-state. But as the nation-state is gradually yielding its sovereignty, the psychological importance of the national community is rising. The attempt to establish an equilibrium between the imperatives of the new internationalism and the need for a more intimate national community is the source of friction and conflicts. Skipping on. In addition, it may be possible and tempting to exploit for strategic political purposes the fruits of research on the brain and on human behavior. Gordon J.F. MacDonald, a geophysicist specializing in problems of warfare, has written that that accurately timed artificially excited electronic strokes, quote, could lead to a pattern of oscillations that produce relatively high power levels over certain regions of the earth. In this way, one could develop a system that would seriously impair the brain's performance of very large populations in selected regions over an extended period, no matter how deeply disturbing the thought of using the environment to manipulate behavior for national advantages. To some, the technology permitting such use will very probably develop within the next few decades. Okay, I'm going to stop there. So basically, he's talking about the development of a nation, not nation state, but a global state, a global consciousness. We're going to start thinking more globally. Why? Because there's an agenda to form a global government. And even more so, he talks about the manipulation techniques in order to get people to start thinking that way. He literally thinks that it's okay to manipulate society, to guide society, use whatever resources are available. And this is going in addition to, I mean, I'm trying to speak in two terms here because I know that people who are listening now or are going to be listening now when I post this as a podcast may not have heard my previous podcast on the Grand Chessboard. If you haven't heard that, go listen to it, please. Because there's a lot more in there. I mean, the two together, it's just totally outrageous. But He's talking about using technology and certain brain wave frequencies to literally make someone's brain not work in certain regions, in certain aspects, so that they can manipulate a society. I mean, unbelievable. Unbelievable. Okay. This is titled "Toward a Planetary Consciousness." Yet it would be wrong to conclude that fragmentation and chaos are the dominant realities of our time. The global human conscious is for the first time beginning to manifest itself. This conscience is a natural extension of a long process of widening man's personal horizons. In the course of time, man's self-identification expanded from his family to his village, to his tribe, to his region, to his nation. More recently, it spread to his continent. Before World War II, it was not as customary as it is now for university students or intellectuals to describe themselves merely as Europeans or Asians. During the last three centuries, the fading of the essentially transnational European aristocracy and the successive nationalization of the Christian Church, of socialism, and of communism have meant that in recent times, most significant political activity has tended to be confined within national compartments. Today, we are again witnessing the emergence of a transnational elite, but now they are composed of international businessmen, scholars, professional men, and public officials. The ties of these new elites cut across national boundaries. Their perspectives are not confined by national traditions, and their interests are more functional than national. These global communities are gaining in strength, and as was true in the Middle Ages, it is likely that before long, the social elites of most of the more advanced countries will be highly internationalist or globalist in spirit and outlook. The creation of a global information grid, facilitating almost continuous intellectual interaction and the pooling of knowledge, will further enhance the present trend towards the international professional elites and toward the emergence of a common scientific language, in effect the function equivalent of Latin. This, however, could create a dangerous gap between them and the politically activated masses, whose quote-unquote nativism, exploited by more nationalist political leaders, could work against the quote-unquote cosmopolitan elites. Nativism. Natives. In the previous book, The Grand Chessboard, he referred to the general society and those who would be against his agenda as, what was the term? Barbarians. Increasingly, the intellectual elites tend to think in terms of global problems. One significant aspect of this process is the way in which contemporary dilemmas are identified. The need to overcome technical backwardness, to eliminate poverty, to extend international cooperation in education and health, To prevent overpopulation, we're going to get into that on a whole other podcast. I'm going to dedicate a whole show just to this question of overpopulation. But you're going to hear a lot more about that as time goes on. To develop effective peacekeeping machinery. These are all global issues. Only 33 years ago, they were simply not in the forefront of the public's attention, which has riveted at the time on much more specific regional, national, and territorial conflicts. Let me see if I'm going to continue on. I think I'm just going to stop there for a second. Let me see. Let me go ahead and skip to another part. I don't want to give it all to you. I want you to read it for yourself. But this is on a chapter, "The Quest for a Universal Vision." And this is one of my favorite chapters in the entire book. And I think I might read this at length to some extent because it's so important. Man came silently into the world, but through his coming is shrouded in mystery, in the sense that we still know little about the actual beginnings of human existence. From the earliest known history, man has given evidence of an intense yearning to understand himself and his environment. However crudely and primitively, man has always sought to crystallize some organizing principle that would, by creating order out of chaos, let me stop there, by creating order out of chaos, order ab cow, let me, please, if you're going to continue to listen to me, write that down, because you're going to hear that again and again and again, order out of chaos. Relate him to the universe and help define his place in it. Despite the disappearance in earlier times of entire cultures, human evolution and social development has involved both an expansion in human and man's awareness of himself and his fellows as a human entity endowed with certain common qualities and an increasingly systematic intellectual effort to define and organize his external reality meaningfully. There has thus been at work what Chardin. Oh, okay, I'm going to go to a commercial break and we'll be back here in just a second.
Maybe you heard me offer the video, The Great Civil War Debate, and because VHS is no longer in style, you thought, well, I'll wait till that's available on DVD. Well, it is now. I have that on DVD, and I'd be glad to send you a copy. A DVD copy doesn't cost very much, and I'd be glad to send you The Great Civil War Debate DVD just whenever you ask for it. And our policy is we give, you give. It's just that informal. Whatever it is you feel you'd like to contribute to Truth Radio, just ask for The Great Civil War Debate when you write in. If you have any interest in the Civil War at all, this is a debate you just have to hear. Our address is P.O. Box 344, Nipomo, California, zip code 93444. That's P.O. Box 344, Nipomo, California. And the zip code is 93444. Looking forward to hearing from you soon. One of the most important issues we face today is the impact of the USA Patriot Act upon our liberties. And you think you understand what that Patriot Act says, and you think you understand its impact. You believe you have a pretty good realization of how serious it is. But let me give you a clue. Until you see the DVD entitled The Cost of Freedom, you don't know the half of the story. You aren't even aware through the fog of the definition of the mountaintops. Well, that's kind of demeaning. Maybe you do, and I don't mean to put you down, but let me just put it to you this way, positively. The Duncan Group, Incorporated, has put together a DVD called The Cost of Freedom. Support Truth Radio to the extent you can, and ask for a copy of The Cost of Freedom, and I'll get it out to you. Thanks.
Okay, we're back. And I'm, you know, just for the people who are just tuning in or whatnot, we are talking about Zbigniew Brzezinski. I don't even know how to say his name right. I have tried several times, forgive me. Zbigniew Brzezinski is the best it's going to get for me. But we're reading this book, Between Two Ages, and the subtitle, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. And this is a continuation of my topic on him from the book The Grand Chessboard, which is another very important read. I would recommend, when it comes to people, especially people, I mean, this is just a generalization, but I'm going to be a lot more specific in just a second. In the general sense, read everybody who sets foreign policy in our country. Please do. You need to understand what the people are doing in your government and using your power to do. It's a fundamental aspect of a democracy and the responsibility of the citizenry to investigate who these, you know, who the power elites are of this country and what they are planning to do with that power that we give them. In a more general, in a more direct sense, Zbigniew Brzezinski is a major person to investigate in so many ways, and it's so fundamental today to investigate him, especially in dealing with his role involving Al Qaeda. and his support from the Mujahideen in the Afghan conflict. So please do the investigation. It's just important. Continuing on, the quest for a universal vision. In terms of the entirety of human existence, that, quote, stream may indeed be a short one, as the critics of the notion of historical progress readily point out. Nevertheless, recorded history does not provide strong evidence of growth, often halting and uneven, but growth nonetheless in man's consciousness of a common human fate, of certain universal cravings, and of common moral standard. Even when they compete, religions and ideologies have increasingly done so in terms of, and for the sake of, principles that seem, when viewed from a historical perspective, more and more to involve semantic and not substantive differences. This is not to deny that practice has often widely differed. It is, however, remarkable that conflicts have been waged over competitive claims to a superior interpretation and application of such universal values as democracy, welfare, individual dignity, and personal freedom. The next chapter, the universal religions. The crucial breakthrough in the development of human self-awareness on a mass scale came with the great religions. The first universal synthesis that simultaneously expanded man's vision both vertically and horizontally, vertically to define in extended and complex terms man's relationship to a God that was not a small group's alone but everybody's, horizontally to articulate a series of imperatives that govern man's obligations to man on the grounds that they all shared a divine spark. Universalism thus emerged as a state of mind even at a time when man was still provincial and isolated in mutually exclusive social-cultural compartments. Sorry, I keep stuttering. I'll do my best I can. Accordingly, the birth of the universal religions represented the appearance of humanity qua humanity, the assertion of man's equality before God in terms of his spirit, his conscience, and his soul, laid the basis for the transcendental importance of the human being and for the much later assertion of the equality of men in their political and social dimensions. In that sense, proselytizing Christianity, which universalized the more limited Greek and Judaic tradition, was a particularly revolutionary force and was viewed as such by established authority, in spite of the distinction it made between equality before God and obeisance to Caesar on Caesar's terms. If human history can be said to involve both a struggle and an evolution toward the progressive liberation of man, then the attainment of equality before the supernatural was the first step on the road. Now, I'm going to stop here and just make some comments. I can go on forever. And he just kind of philosophizes for a while. Don't get me wrong. He's talking about it in a pretty positive sense. He's talking about the universal religion, universalism, the connection that all these religions have to one another in the basic sense, and cooperation between them. Don't get me wrong. And later on in this book, he talks about the elimination of religion, because religion is a dogma that is causing people to stand in the way of the progress of society towards this world government. And it needs to be eliminated. And he even gives a little hint on how to help that happen. He's basically saying that it's happening on its own, but I know that it's being guided. Now, I have my religious beliefs, and I've said on my podcast, and I'll say on this radio show, I'm not interested in preaching at you my religious beliefs. I'm only interested in presenting you with information. So I never say what I believe, and I don't intend to ever do that, I don't think. I mean, it may come up in the future, but the problem is that people today tend not to listen to you based upon what you believe in terms of religion. And even more so, I'm not trying to be listened to. I'm just trying to give you information so that you'll go find out for yourself. Because regardless of whether or not you agree with his religious views, other people's religious views affect you. So you need to know what they are. I believe everybody should have the right to believe whatever they want. I believe in freedom as a fundamental aspect. That's why I name my website Truth, Love, Freedom. But there's some people who do not believe in freedom, especially religious and political freedom. And Zbigniew Brzezinski is one of those people who believe that he has to, that he's somehow more enlightened than the rest of society. And it's his responsibility to, or him and his constituents and the elites, to guide mankind towards a society vision, which I call a utopian vision of theirs, that they believe is best for all of humanity. And the problem is that we're just too uneducated and dumb to know it. And that's really what they say. You'll hear that kind of talk, even though it's covered with a lot of fancy language and, you know, extensive concepts. But ultimately, it is the same. It's the same thing. They believe in a vision of society, a utopian vision that's really unique. And it can take a long time to understand the development of this utopian idealism that they has been developing for like 1,000+ years. And we're really close to it. And that utopian vision is the elimination of religion and the formation of a world society or world culture or world government. And we're going to talk. He's going to get a little bit more into what that society, that utopian vision actually looks like in just a second. Okay, this is under the chapter, The National Identity. And, let me see here. With the growth of the West of man's ability to master his environment, secular rationalism, accompanied by a greater awareness of social complexity as well as a breakdown in the existing structure of religious alliances, emerged to challenge institutionalized religion. That religion allegiance simultaneously rested on the narrowness and on universalism of man's horizons. The narrowness derived from the massive ignorance, illiteracy, and the vision confined to the immediate environment by limited communications. The universalism was provided by the acceptance of the idea that man's destiny is essentially in God's hands, and that the limited present and is but a stepping stone to an unlimited future. Okay, so let me stop here and make a comment. And I've said this in past things. I'm going to have to always repeat myself because I'm kind of on a new... I'm on a station now. It's a little bit different than what I'm used to. I'm used to going through and editing and, you know, people who are listening to my podcast, you know, I don't have to repeat myself, but I may have a new audience here. So let me get a little bit more specific on where I'm coming from here and what this proves, why I'm reading it. It's kind of an abstract they. I'll get into who they are on another podcast, and that's kind of what's developing here. There is a philosophy among elites in this nation that religion is a primitive aspect of man's nature. Religion is what man looks to when they're ignorant and they don't understand the world around them, but science is going to replace that. And the worship of the nation state, the national government, or the world government, and a form of humanism is going to replace that. And that it's already occurring today, and they're watching it happen. But they're also helping it happen. They literally say that they are doing things to try to bring society into that. And, you know, you talk about forms of manipulation and things of that sort, using the media. I mean, this is not secret stuff. This is not conspiracy theory. This is what they say. And as I go on, I have a lot of content to get through. If you keep listening to me, you will learn that it's true. I'm not theorizing here. This is a fact. These people are actually guiding society, using the mechanisms and manipulations and lies to try to curve your opinion, the people you know, your family, your children, your grandchildren, and anybody who's coming in the future to develop into what their vision is for a future society. That religion is a primitive aspect of man's character. That man, before he understood the world around him, needed to explain things and did so by using it as gods. So let me read this again. Now that having said that, let's read this again so you can understand what he's really saying. That religious allegiance simultaneously rested on the narrowness and on the universalism of man's horizons. The narrowness derived from massive ignorance, illiteracy, and a vision confined to the immediate environment by limited communications. The universalism was provided by the acceptance of the idea that man's destiny is essentially in God's hands, and that the limited present is but a stepping stone in the unlimited future. Emerging secularism challenged both dimensions, and in so doing required for an external projection of man's identity an intermediately focus of loyalty, something in between the immediate and the infinite. The nation state and nationalism were the responses. The doctrine of sovereignty created the institutional basis for challenging the secular authority of established religion. And this challenge in turn paved the way for the emergence of an abstract conception of the nation state. Sovereignty vested in the people, instead of sovereignty vested in the king, was the consummation of the process, which in the two centuries preceding the French and American revolutions radically altered the structure of authority in the West and prepared the ground for a new dominant concept of reality. I hope this isn't too complex for you. And please, if you have to, I'm going to have this podcast on my website, truthlovefreedom.org, I think. I'm pretty sure. Check. And you can listen to it again and again and again. I think Truth Radio also is recording it. And it's like lesser quality if you're not understanding what I'm saying. Maybe you should listen to my quality a little bit better because I'm recording it right on here on my computer right now in high quality. But either way, I want you to understand this stuff. This is so important. I can't go through every single sentence and break it down for you, but take the time. If you have to, grab a dictionary. You know, I know this guy is really wordy, and he's actually been criticized as being so, but I think he does that because he wants to try to turn off people who are not into, you know, his ideas of who should be reading his book. Okay. The nation-state became simultaneously the embodiment of personal commitments and the point of departure for analyzing reality. This development marked a new phase in man's political consciousness. Nationalism did not seek to direct the individual toward the infinite, but to activate the impersonal masses for the sake of immediate proximate goals. Paradoxically, these concrete goals were derived from the still intangible and transcendental, though new, object of worship, the nation. Let me read that for you again. Paradoxically, these concrete goals were derived from the still intangible and transcendental, though new, object of worship, the nation. The nation became the source of ecstatic, lyrical affection, and it was this highly emotional relationship symbolized by the new anthems, flags, and heroes that served to energize the populace. The concrete goals took the form of massive preoccupation with frontiers, brethren to be regained from foreign captivity, and more generally the power and the glory of the state as a formal expression of the nation. The state thus became the institutional form for the new dominant belief, with monopolistic claim on the active dedication to it of man, now designated first and above all as the citizen. Okay, so we're talking about the evolution of religion to the revolution of patriotism, and he's going to get into more. I still haven't got halfway through this book yet. I'm already halfway through my 2 hours. And we're going to come up on a commercial here in just a minute. I can just read parts of it to you and emphasize things to you, but you need to read it. I mean, that's what it boils down to. And I really hope that, you know, you're not so, you know, if you have to miss you know, American Idol for a night to read this book, I think that it might change your life, because it's pretty outrageous, some of the things that are said in here. And I'm, you know, I'm going to say some of the best stuff, but there's definitely a lot of other stuff. I mean, it's overwhelming. And I would encourage you to go to your local library, pick up a couple of his books, and read them. And I can't stress to you how important that is. We're going to go to a commercial here in just a second, and we'll be back.
Encourage your friends and family to listen in to your favorite programs on Truth Radio Network. Tell them to listen on the World Wide Web at www.truthradio.com.
Okay, we're back. We're going to read more from Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor to Carter, among many other things, founding member of the Trilateral Commission, member for the Center for Strategic and International Studies at John Hopkins University, professor at multiple universities, honorary professor, author of many books, and considered to be the foreign policy guru of our nation, often referred to as the Democratic Kissinger. And Kissinger's another fun guy that we're going to read a lot on. I'm going to actually go through many of his books as well. There's a lot to be said by those guys. It's not good. Not for us. Not for the average person. Unless you are somebody who wants to give up your rights and your sovereignty and your belief in God or anything else to a government who thinks they know better than you do. And let me move on here. This chapter's... The main chapter is called The Age of Volatile Belief. And that's pretty revealing, I know. The subchapter is called Organized Christianity. Very interesting. Give me a second here as I get it together. Want to make sure I cover the more important stuff. I might miss it on this one because I didn't have this one prepared. I just wanted to throw it in there. Since I brought religion into it, I'm more or less talking about politics, but that, you know, religion and politics, I believe, go hand in hand. I mean, they really do. And, you know, most of the world's politics is governed in some, or influenced in a major way, by someone's religious beliefs, or lack thereof. I mean, it doesn't really make a difference, because your idea of how to perceive the world is based upon how you perceive yourself and your relationship to it, which is often a religious philosophy or aspect. And you know, a person coming from a humanist worldview, looking at religions as a primitive aspect of man's nature, is an elitist mentality for sure. Certain. I'm getting some feedback here. Organized Christianity. Equally dramatic, though different in substance, is the problem confronted today by established religions, especially Christianity. Unlike communism, contemporary Christianity is no longer a system of power. Its temporal authority is not only limited, but shrinking. On the other hand, it is both a system of doctrines and an institution, particularly in its Catholic expression. The tension between the beliefs and the institution is ancient, often painful, history for the Church. But the problem has been given a new dimension by the efforts initiated by Popes John the 23rd and Paul the 6th, and expressed by a second ecumenical council, Vatican II, to reinvigorate the Church. These efforts are taking place in a setting that simultaneously involves both unprecedented interest in the part of concerned Christians, not only Catholics, and widespread evidence of increasing indifference to the prescribed religious forms. In other words, there is both massive involvement in change, which means that the official guardians of the institution cannot fully control it, and uncertainty concerning the best ways to make the Church again truly relevant, without diluting its spiritual identity. The fundamental dilemma confronted by the church is the words of Unamuno, or Unamuno, is that Catholicism oscillates between mysticism, which is the inward experience of the living God in Christ, and instrumentable experience, the danger of which, however, is that it absorbs our own personality in God, and so does not save our vital longing. Between mysticism and the rationalism which it fights against, it oscillates between religionized science and scientificized religion. To opt for one is to deprive of the other, yet neither will do by itself. Mysticism would mean withdrawal from the contemporary world. Scientism would mean absorption by it. This is an old dilemma for the church, and it has been posed and answered in different ways at different historical stages. Mater et Magistra, the Vatican II, occurring in an age shaped by ideological conflict, scientific innovation, mass popular awakening, political passion, and religious can be viewed as an effort to satisfy three broad objectives. First, to update the church's institutional structure so that it is not an impending impediment to the vitality of the ideological component to use of a term applied throughout the chapter, and so that the institutionalized beliefs again became meaningful to both the inner and external dimensions of human life. Second, better to focus the energies of the church as a whole on social problems that range from personal poverty and social injustice to international inequality. And finally, to heal doctrinal splits within Christianity and in the era of bigotry and conflict between Christianity and non-Christian religions. The effort, precisely because it did move the church somewhat in the desired directions, produced new strains in the relationship between ideas and institutions. Institutional reform conducted at a time when pressures for theological adjustments have increasingly come from the church hierarchy itself. As in the case of communism, these pressures have more often come from the periphery than from the center. What Yugoslavia has been to the Kremlin, the Netherlands has become to the Vatican, has prompted a profound crisis of papal authority. Pope Paul's reiteration of the ban on artificial contraception in... which came shortly after the adoption by Vatican II of the concept of collegiality in the church affairs, provoked strong negative reactions from various national councils of bishops. These reactions in turn prompted the pontiff to warn against, quote, attitudes which depart more than a little from the traditional doctrine of the church and menace order in the bosom of the church herself. Yet the Vatican could not stifle the theological unrest, almost echoing the demands of a Marxist philosopher. Excuse me, that's my phone and I don't even know where it's at. Sorry about that. Caught me off guard. I thought I had all my phones turned off, but it isn't the case. Okay, let me continue here. Let me go ahead and skip to the end here. All this stuff is interesting. I mean, every little aspect of it. He's basically breaking down what is going on in the world today, and then he sums it up with little statements and ends off talking about how, you know, the end of religion is not only at hand, it's in process. And that because of that, it's a natural consequence to expect that certain political things are going to be about to change towards a humanist worldview, and which coincidentally goes right along with what he has as his agenda. So let me skip more towards the back. This is under the chapter "The Third American Revolution." I'm just going to read a little bit here and comment on it. The Third American Revolution is even harder to define. We are now in the middle of it, and thus cannot be certain of its outer outcome. In one respect, however, it is easier to identify than the second, for its impact and its effect are more concentrated in time. The Third Revolution began gathering momentum after World War II, with the massive entrance into colleges of XGIs, with the explosion in higher learning, and the growing acceptance of social primacy of education, with the union of national power and modern science, crowned by the harnessing of nuclear energy and the federal government emerging as a major sponsor of scientific investigation. With the sudden birth of rapid continental communications, ranging from the world's most modern and developed highway systems, through rapid air passenger transport, to uniquely effective instant transcontinental telephone system, and finally to a nationwide television intimacy, with the transformation in the managerial techniques wrought by the appearance of computers and other electronic devices that conquered complexities, distance, and even the diffusion of authority, and with the fading of industry as the most important source of employment for most Americans. Prompted by technology, and particularly electronics, the Third Revolution is changing the basic institutions and values of American society, and, as was also the case with the preceding revolutions, it is encountering resistance, simulating violence, causing anxiety, and stirring hope. In the process, it is creating three Americas in one. There is the emerging new America, symbolized by the new complexes of learning, research, and development that link institutions of higher learning with society and create unprecedented opportunities for innovation and experimentation, in addition to sparking increasing interest in the fine arts and culture, as is evidenced by new museums and art centers. Technotronic America is in the electronics laboratories and centers of learning along the Route 128 surrounding Boston. It is the academic scientific conglomerates around Los Angeles and San Francisco, and it is the new frontier industry. The suburban middle class increasingly gravitates toward this America, though frequently resenting its scientism and nostalgically yearning for a more community and more community and stability. I'm going to skip through here. The new America is not only taking shape today. Not only does a child face a radical rupture with the past, but he must be trained for an unknown future. And this task confronts the entire society as well. The current transformation also poses profound philosophical issues concerning the very essence of social existence. Since it is largely derived from an unprecedented expansion of scientific power over both man's environment and man himself, studies of change cumulatively reinforce the picture of a society undergoing a far-reaching and technologically induced revolution. Okay? So we went in here, we talked about things, the changes that are occurring, he's talking about technologies changing, and basically the whole thing's about change. But change towards what? What is he changing towards? What are we looking towards here? This chapter is entitled "The American Future." If the problems that confront America were neither recognized nor anticipated, the inherent dangers would be even greater. Such is not the case. Contemporary America is perhaps more candidly critical and more demanding of itself than any other society. National reports pinpointing the society's failure, devastating critiques of national shortcomings, elaborate efforts at social stock-taking, all reflect a more introspective and deliberately sober national mood. Studies of the future organized on a large scale, both by a special academic commission and by well-endowed private institutions, indicate mounting national recognition that the future can and must be planned. That unless there is a modicum of deliberate choice, change will result in chaos. He uses that word chaos a lot. It's a fear factor. He's always bringing up that if it's not controlled, chaos will emerge. And like I said, I'll just reference the Grand Chessboard again. And if you listen to it, you'll know what I'm talking about. This is not guaranteed that a national response will actually be mounted. But it does indicate a more pervasive awareness among leading sectors of society of the need for a deliberate response. The historical vitality of the United States system derives from a deeply rooted commitment of the American people to the idea of democratic change. The American tradition of free dialogue and hierarchically unfettered expression of disagreement has been an important factor in the developing this responsiveness to change. It has made it possible to exploit protest movements and thereby render them historically superfluous by adapting and adopting their programs. This is to deny neither the element of violence in American history nor to oft-noted conservatism of the electorate. Nevertheless, the fundamental reality of American life has been the assimilation of the rapid change induced by the frontier, by immigration, by the industry growth, and by industrial growth. Sorry, I'm trying to read. I'm not very good at reading out loud. A dynamic socioeconomic reality has blended with a certain political conservatism, and created a pluralist socio-political system that has, in the past, proven itself to be a remarkably resilient and absorbing extraordinary change. It possesses a structural quality capable of generating and deciphering warning signals of mounting social stress. I'm going to skip through some other stuff. As a result, more Americans recognize that two broad areas of needed and, it is to be hoped, developing change involve the institutional and the cultural aspects of American society. The former largely, though not exclusively, pertains to the political sphere. The latter to the educational domain, particularly as it concerns the continent and the shaping of national values. More deliberate change in both realms would serve as a catalyst for reform and other areas of national life, providing both the framework and the motivation for a timely adoption of needed remedies. Okay, so to summarize what he's saying there, change is coming, and everything's lined up for change. Change towards what, though? He's still not really getting to what it's all about, right? I mean, he's just kind of laying out his case. We've got technology, we've got all these technological advancements happening, all these historical issues that have occurred and whatnot, and you see things progressing a certain way. There's all these challenges that are emerging, and challenges that were of the past are dying down or totally gone. But what does that mean? I mean, obviously you got to be asking yourself that, and in a second it's going to be the punchline. Okay, and the final enchilada here, and let me see where we're at on a commercial break. We're going to go into commercial break here in just a second, so I'm going to read this, and then I'm going to comment on it. I'm going to stir around for some more stuff to talk about involving my friend Zbigniew. To sum up, though the objective of shaping a community of developed nations is less ambiguous than the goal of world government, it is more attainable. It is more ambitious than the concept of an Atlantic community, but more historically more relevant to the new spatial revolution. Though cognizant of present divisions between communist and non-communist nations, it attempts to create a framework for international affairs, not by exploiting these divisions, but rather by striving to preserve and create openings for eventual reconciliation. Finally, it recognizes that the world's developed nations have a certain affinity, and that only by nurturing a greater sense of communality among them can an effective response to the increasingly threat of global fragmentation, which itself intensifies the growing worldwide impatience with human inequality, be mounted. So we'll be back after a commercial break.
Let me say it for you so you don't have to. Who wants to know anything more about the JFK assassination? Well, I'll tell you who. You! Once you see the DVD I can send you from Truth Radio on that subject, you will be so grateful. You'll start listening to this thing and watching it. You'll say, this I have seen over and over again. Where are we going with this? Why do we have to be bored by all this repetition? And then, about a third of the way through this DVD, your eyes will be so far wide open. You will be astonished at the documentation and the new information, the startling revelations. Ask for the JFK DVD when you write Truth Radio, P.O. Box 344, Nipomo, California, 93444. Do it today.
And this is Bishop Truman Burst, Master Herbalist for 43 years. We've offered free natural health counseling. And we are a Christian evangelical church and in Albany, Oregon. And we share the gospel of the good news and how to be healed in every part of your life, spiritually and physically. Call Truman at 1-800-345-4152, extension 0. Listen and call in to Discoveries in Health Monday through Friday, 11 to 12 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, USA, on truthradio.com.
Okay. Continuing on from where we left off, let me see. I gotta decide if I'm gonna read all the way to the end here. No, I think I'm going to just go ahead and leave it at that. I think it makes it pretty clear there what he's talking about. I mean, let me just read that one part again. To sum up, though the objective of shaping a community of developed nations is less ambitious than the goal of world government, it is more attainable. So world government isn't attainable right now. What are they seeking? Since it's not attainable now, of course, because that's what they want, since it isn't attainable now, what we need to do is seek out a community of developed nations. That's the United Nations. We have a podcast on it. Go check it out on the truthlovefreedom.org. And, you know, the thing about it is, this is just one person. I have a library of books of people saying the same thing from all different facets. You have Kissinger talking about his new world order. You have Brzezinski. You have Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, which is a product of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the beginning of Brzezinski was the chair of. And you know, it just goes in circles. They're all connected. The question is, what is connecting them? And that's what I really want to get at more than anything. And the thing is, is that when I get into people, there's people who know about this stuff, and I talk to them and I say, you know, what do you think is going on? And the answer I always get is that it's either, well, it's either Zionism, it's the Jesuits, it's, you know, the money. They're all about the money. You know, it's power as a motivation, all these things. Let's look at this from a historical standpoint. This has been a developing philosophy for nearly 1,000 years. Even if you don't want to talk about, let's get specific on just the word, the new world, or the term, the New World Order, or whatever you want to think that is. I have my opinions. The New World Order was talked about for over 100 years. Most of the people who started talking about it are dead. Many of which were already in positions of power when they started talking about it. They didn't get there talking about it. So, you know what I'm saying? That's before Zionism even existed. You know, and it just amazes me that when I talk to people and they're trying to understand where this stuff is coming from, because we see it happening today, and you'll continue to see it, I promise you. Things are moving very quickly, and in your future is not going to see a shortage of movements in this direction, I promise you. We got the NAFTA superhighway coming through our country, and they say, oh, it's not a NAFTA superhighway. No, it is a NAFTA superhighway. I have documentation proving that it was spoken of in the House and by many different representatives, both from the government and from various industries who I guess thought they might benefit from such a thing, and they all referred to it as the NAFTA superhighway. You know, there's talk about a united currency and things of this sort. You see a lot of the same types of movements happening in the United States that happened to Europe prior to the formulation of the European Union. This is happening. And when I get into this stuff, most of where I hear this stuff coming from is the religious side of things. And I got into the New Age a little bit. I talked about this woman named Alice Bailey, which literally has a progression of steps towards what the New World Order. Published in 1930-something. So what do you think it is? What is the motivation? There's got to be something behind this, because not only are they finding themselves continuously maintaining their agenda for a very prolonged period of time, but they're also gaining people in their support all over the world and all governments. I mean, it's not like the United States is going to take over the world and then say, okay, we're a world government now. No, that's not what they have in mind. They're talking about merging. There's definitely something behind it. I know what I think it is, and I could just tell you, but I'm not going to. I'm going to basically continue to teach on various topics, and I hope I keep you lured in. I hope you stay with me on this if you don't already know, because it's important that you do. There's no way you're going to stop an agenda that you don't understand. And my goal in my life is to educate people so we can work together to try to stop this. I don't believe it's in our best interest, and I believe the utopian vision, and this is a basic philosophical premise, one person's utopian vision is another person's tyranny, okay? There's no way a person's utopian vision, unless it was a vision that required a democracy where everybody had the freedom to believe whatever they wanted regardless, not once you get everybody to believe the same thing, but that they are able to have differentiating opinions and beliefs and political ideals and be able to live with each other in harmony. And that's, I think, a little bit ridiculous to expect such a thing. I mean, we can hope, but I don't think it's realistic. To manipulate and cause people to come into a system of believing that is more harmonic with your ideas about what should happen is tyranny to the person that's being manipulated. It may be a utopia to the person who's pushing the agenda, but essentially it is tyranny. And that is a huge flaw here, because the people who are involved in this thing literally believe that they know better than us. It's deceiving, and it's shocking, it's scary, it's completely frightening. Because, you know, we've seen what happened in the past when too much power was put into the hands of a few people who thought they knew what was best. And it's not good. It's not good at all. So let me get into something. I want to read. I've done this on the previous podcast, but I want to do this because I want, this comes from SourceWatch, which is a wonderful website, sourcewatch.org. I love the website. They do a great job tracking the who's who's of our government and various sources of political movements and things of that sort. I highly recommend that you go and check it out. So I'm going to read this to you because it breaks down not only the clout that this guy has, but also some other aspects of Zbigniew. Zbigniew Brzezinski was born in Warsaw, Poland in 1928, the son of a diplomatic a diplomat posted to Canada in 1938, serves as counselor, Center for Strategic and International Studies, and is professor of American foreign policy at Paul H. Neitz School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Washington, D.C. Brzezinski is said to be the protege of both Nelson A. Rockefeller and Paul H. Neitz, C. Neitz School. His CSIS, which is Strategic Center for Strategic and International Studies profile, states this. In the private sector, Brzezinski serves as, quote, international advisor of several major U.S. global corporations, unquote. He is a frequent participant in annual business/trade conventions and is the president of ZB Incorporated, an advisory firm on international issues to corporations and financial institutions. Also a frequent public speaker and commentator on major domestic and foreign TV programs and contributor to the domestic and foreign newspapers and journals. Brzezinski's career with the U.S. government spans several presidents, advisor to John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson, policy advisor to James Earl Carter Jr. and George Herbert Walker Bush's co-chair on the National Security Advisory Task Force in 1988. He earned his B.A. in 1949 and M.A. from 1950 at McGill University and his Ph.D. at Harvard in 1953. He holds honorary degrees from several universities. Honorary trustee at the Institute of International Education, International Advisory Board, Journal of Democracy, honorary member of the Academy of Political Science. And then he goes a little bit into what I talked about earlier about his involvement with Al-Qaeda and how he's the person who literally created Al-Qaeda, okay? He's the mind behind it. Thank him for it. I bet he takes no responsibility for 9/11, though. Higher education institution affiliations. 1949 to 50, he McGill University, he got his BA, MA. 1953, Harvard University, he got his PhD. In 1953 to 1960, he was on faculty at Harvard University. On 1960 to 1989, faculty at Columbia University. This is his political positions held. From 1966 to 68, member of the Policy Planning Council of the Department of State. From 1968 on, Hubert H. Humphrey Presidential Campaign, Chairman of Foreign Policy Task Force. 1973 to 1976, Trilateral Commission, he was the director. That's a very important organization, I'll talk about that in just a second. 1976, James Earl Carter Jr., Presidential Campaign Foreign Policy Advisor. 1977 to 80, he was James Earl Carter's National Security Advisor. 1985, Ronald Reagan's Chemical Warfare Commission. 1987 to 88, National Security Council Defense Department Commission on Integrated Long-Term Strategy. 1988, George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisory Task Force. 1989, President Reagan's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. So, I mean, several presidents, long period of time. Is there any doubt of the man's influence? I mean, is there? There shouldn't be. Affiliations. Member of the Advisory Board for America Abroad Media, Advisory Board for Partnership for a Secure America, Chair of the American Committee for Peace in Chechnya, Honorary Chairman, AmeriCares Foundation, also used by the CIA to finance Solidarity in Poland in the 80s, Former Director, Amnesty International, Honorary Council of Advisors, American-Turkish Council, Chairman of the American-Ukrainian Advisory Committee, which he organized, former Director of the Atlantic Council, Center for Strategic and International Studies, Director of the Council on Foreign Relations, another wonderful organization that's bringing us closer to world government, Trustee for the Freedom House, Chairman, International Advisory Board for the Yale Project on the Future, Culture, and Civilization of China. Vice Chair for the International Crisis Group, Director of Jamestown Foundation, Director of the Polish-American Enterprises Fund, it's a supposedly a CIA front organization, Director of the Polish-American Freedom Foundation, another CIA front organization, former Director, National Endowment for Democracy, an organization that's funded by Congress, Governor of the Smith Richardson Foundation, Trustee of the Trilateral Commission, Advisory U.S. Azerbaijan, I'm sorry, I can't even pronounce that, Chamber of Commerce, Advisory Committee for AmeriCares. And his influence is phenomenal. When he writes a book, the people who set foreign policy in our country read it, and they follow it. They believe in it. And they're all kind of coming from the same place, so it's important to understand this man and his influence on the world that you live in and the death that has occurred because of his policies, and there's probably a lot more to come. So let's talk for a second about the Trilateral Commission. Now, the Trilateral Commission is an international, it's supposed to be a vehicle for multinational consolidation of commercial and banking interests, and they do so by seizing control of political governments. let me see. So, according to the organization's website, the North American group of the Trilateral Commission includes a maximum of 85 U.S. members, 15 Canadian members, and since 2007, Mexican members. So, it's specifically a trilateral, meaning Canada, United States, and Mexico. The first American chairman was Gerard Smith, and this was... He's a former head of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and chief U.S. negotiator for SALT I, who served as trilateral chairman until he entered the James Earl Center Jr. administration as ambassador at large in charge of non-proliferation issues. The next chairman was David Rockefeller, and I think many people on here, I've heard David Rockefeller on this station many times already. And you probably are familiar with David Rockefeller. If you're not, you will definitely hear about him if you continue to listen to me, because I'm going to cover an entire session on the Rockefellers, who had played a central role in the formation of the Trilateral Commission and continues to be recognized as the founder and honorary chairman. He was succeeded by Paul Adolf Walser, former chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve Board. Another issue we're going to get into in the future. Who now serves as honorary North American chairman. The president of the North American, the present North American chairman is Thomas S. Foley. He's a former speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and a former U.S. ambassador to Japan. The North American deputy chairman are the heads of the Canadian and Mexican groups. On the Canadian side, we have Jean-Luc Pepin, who was succeeded by Mitchell Sharp, former foreign minister. When Mr. Sharp left the government service, and Mr. Pepin returned to the government service. I'll just go ahead and skip all this. Now, the funding for this organization came from the Ford Foundation, and there's a lot of stuff involving that. Charity organizations. We're going to get into those in the future as well. But a grant from the Ford Foundation was the most important part of the financial base of the Trilateral Commission in the first 3 years. Fundraising has been decentralized since that time. In the United States, an increasing portion of the needed financial support has come from a wide range of corporations, no doubt. Foundation support remains important, particularly for some project work, as does the support of some individuals. Okay, let me go ahead and skip down some of this stuff here. Let's talk about the Council on Foreign Relations. It states that it is dedicated to increasing America's understanding of the world and contributing ideas to U.S. foreign policy. The council accomplishes this mainly by promoting constructive debates and discussions, clarifying world issues, and publishing foreign affairs. excuse me. The Council on Foreign Relations was the founding force behind many different organizations, and we'll get into more of those in the future. We'll go to a commercial break. We'll be back in just a second.
The most remarkable times when we could be thousands of miles separated and still feel very close to each other. And that's the case with our advertiser, Michael Dees, who operates Mammoth Automotive in Lowell, Indiana. There at Lowell's premier auto repair shop, Michael will be able to meet all your needs if you are near enough to drive in there to find him. But if you have common interest with this fellow who really knows cars and says, if I can't fix it, it ain't broke. Well, go to his website. It's madnessautomotive.com, and there you will find a link to Truth Radio. It goes naturally right into the flow of the text of his very well-put-together website. If it's a car, he can fix it. And so if you're traveling through, put him on your list. He's there in Lowell, Indiana, at 279 West Meadow Place. Madness Automotive, 279 West Meadow Place, Lowell, Indiana. If I were on Fox News, I would know better than to think that my listeners would be interested in a DVD having to do with history. You are different, though. I think you would really benefit by watching a DVD of a video I've had in my library for a long time. It's called The Mena Cover-Up. Mena, Arkansas. Yes, Mena, Arkansas. That's the place where George Bush the First and Bill Clinton first did business together. It's all told in a book by Terry Reed, and that book's name is Compromise. But this video is something else. This is where you see the pictures and the real interviews and the whole story about how drugs brought Bill Clinton to the presidency. Right for the Mena Cover-Up DVD, when you write Truth Radio, P.O. Box 344, Nipomo, California, zip code 93444. That's P.O. Box 344, Nipomo 93444.
Okay. So I just want to talk about a few things here real quick. Number one, we are trying to acquire better equipment for the show. I'm trying to get more organized. I'm trying to get this thing down, this whole live show thing. It's taken a little while for me to understand how to do this the right way. The cool thing about it was when I was doing my podcast is I would record 2 to 3 hours of me rambling on. I would, go through with the WAV file and just delete it and get rid of all the stuff that made me sound stupid, and just keep the good stuff. Narrow it down to about an hour of the good stuff, and it was usually a pretty decent show, or something to listen to. And I'm kind of choppy here and there, and I'm starting to realize the full complexity of doing a 2-hour show because there's a lot of content that I need to share. But I find myself like my throat is starting to hurt right now because I've been talking for about 2 hours. And I know when I have Justin, my co-host, here with me, it'll be a lot easier. But Either way, we need to raise around $700. We need to get a condenser mic. We want to get a little unit where we can call in and have better quality coming through the radio station. In addition to that, there's a $300 to $400 unit I want to buy that's a little... and this is in addition to that, because the other stuff is far more important. But it's this little unit that hooks up to my phone. Actually, it's through... it's used as a... what do you call it? Bluetooth technology. And it allows me to call into the station and broadcast live from various places. And if you don't know, we're going to get into this in a future date, but there's this thing called the Bohemian Grove. It's a meeting that occurs once a year. I think it takes place in June. I'm going to be going to that to protest, and I would like to do a live broadcast during the Bohemian Grove event. And actually, it'd be... I know it's going to be a little funny, but I'm going to try to find myself somebody to give some interviews to. And there's going to be various people there protesting that go there every year. Things like that. I want to start traveling and go into various events and participating in them and also broadcasting from them live, giving you updates as we watch people drive in, sending pictures and blogging live right there from the location. So we need some money, and I want to produce a show that or a source of information that is gonna help assist you in understanding what's going on in the world today and help you keep a watch on the agendas that are unfolding. But I need help because I don't have the financial ability to take care of the stuff myself. I'm limited on what I can do. I paid a severe amount of money just to get myself into a position to do the few things that I'm doing. I'm going to be putting out a series of videos that are going to be leading up to a DVD that I'm going to be putting out, basically explaining various concepts. Actually, it's probably going to end up becoming various DVDs because I don't see how I can get into the detail that I want to get into on either the subject matter in a single DVD. It just doesn't seem really possible. So I'm going to put out a DVD starting out that's very basic, and then I'm going to be building on that and putting out other ones. In addition to that, I'm working right now on the occult symbolism, the Freemasonic symbolism of the dollar bill. I watched they had a news report about a month ago that was a total slaughter. I mean, it was totally ridiculous, the stuff that they would say and the way they simplified the symbols. And I can prove without a doubt that it's Masonic. Masons do not doubt that it is Masonic. I have various quotes from Masonic sources. But the important thing to understand is what the symbol means, because we're talking about the New World Order and the world government. Right underneath that symbol, it says Novus Ordo Seclorum, which means New Order of the Ages, or the New World Government, or New World Order. And we hear talk like that from people like George Bush. He said New World Order, and there's various other people that I've read in past podcasts. Kissinger speaks frequently about the New World Order. And actually, the person that Zbigniew Brzezinski thanked in the beginning of his book, Samuel P. Huntington, spoke frequently about the coming world order, or the political order that is changing societies. Very interesting stuff. They're all using the same terminology. What is it? Why is it there? And where did it come from? These are important questions. And it's going to take a long time to answer every aspect of the questions, but if for people who have listened to my podcast thus far, I'm sure they're starting to formulate a conclusion that the agenda's there, and there's definitely political and religious aspects to it, and they are very much involved in our government, and they are willing to harass, co-opt, control, manipulate, and anything else they have to do in order to accomplish it. There is going to be nothing that's going to stand in its way. Definitely nothing of moral consequence. And there's various forms by which this is being accomplished. Most of them are by various institutions. And understanding these institutions is fundamental to understanding how to stop it, because these people are paying attention to what we are doing to try to stop them, and they're working in the way they can to prevent us from being able to do that. And things are getting really scary, guys. I mean, we're at a point in history now where you can't even protest at these places. You have to protest in what they call free speech zones, or sections of town where you're away from where you're actually needing to protest. And they'll violate our civil liberties consistently, constantly. violating our civil liberties, and the majority of society does not know about it. The media does not repeat on it, or does not report on it. And you got to ask yourself, how is it that so many organizations, so many powerful people, are all working towards the same goal, working in unison with one another, keeping it a secret? Information that could be told. I mean, I can just imagine if half of what was written in Zbigniew Brzezinski's books, if one of those statements were read out loud on national television, it would cause a backlash from society. And reporters are always acting like they're stretching to try to catch politicians with their pants down, right? Why not just read their books and quote them? Because obviously they don't want to do that. It's not in their interest. Trilateral Commission. Who are the members? You have and the Council on Foreign Relations. You have members of the media. All the major media in the country are the heads of the major media and representatives of those organizations, institutions are members and attend frequently. Banking institutions, multinational corporations, the military industrial complex. Various members of government, including the very important ones, the oversight committees and whatnot, all members, all attend, in secret. They do not publish what they talk about. They're meeting with members from all over the world. You got things like the Bilderberg Group, the Bohemian Grove, Bohemian Club, and various other organizations that all come together in secret, and they talk about stuff. And they always make it sound like there's nothing sinister going on. Yet, we can see evidence of a pursuit for this agenda for the New World Order. And it goes without saying that it's happening. I mean, there's no way to... They deny it, but, I mean, if somebody has half a brain and does any just a little bit of research, you can find out that it's absolutely true. So the question is, and this is the question that I'm going to pose over and over again, who's behind it? What is this about? That's the fundamental question. And I've been dabbling for a long time in politics here. Actually, I started out my first two podcasts with religion. Well, first three or four, actually, in religion, and then got into politics. Now I'm going to kind of dip back into religion a little bit here in the future. It's going to be a couple more shows maybe of politics. But I'm going to dip back into religion because religion is the core of where these beliefs are coming from. I remember I talked about earlier, religion affects politics. It's a fact of nature. It's nothing that you can deny. And to understand what religions are affecting it, like let me make something clear. I'm not against anyone's religion. I'm against religions that set agendas that suppress people. Period. I don't care what you believe. You know, if you want to believe any god, you want to believe a tree's a god or whatever, it doesn't matter to me. You can believe whatever you want. But if you start taking your religious views and your beliefs and trying to enforce me to live a certain way and have it affect my life without against my will, we have a problem. And if you have, in the same sense, if you do it to anybody else's will and affecting their life, we have a problem. I'll stand up for them too. And that's the real basis behind my conflict with this whole agenda. They want world government. Fine. I don't care. They want, you know, various... They want to be wealthy. They want to be rich. That's fine. But when you're being rich has to do with me being poor, we have a problem. If I can't achieve what I want to achieve because in order for you to be rich, then we have a problem. And not just me, everybody else. You know, we all deserve the right to be able to live freely, happily, and pursue the God-given rights that we were handed, you know. And that's the fundamental aspect of the whole thing. So, let's see here. Let me summarize something here real quick. I mean, one last quote for those who did not hear the Grand Chessboard, because I think you will find it really, really infuriating. It's unbelievable. This book. I mean, the Between Two Ages is very interesting because it breaks down his perspective of where he's coming from. But the Grand Chessboard is unbelievable. It really is. So I'm going to go through some key quotes here, and I want this to resonate hard with you because this guy has power and he's affecting your life. Ever since the continent started interacting politically some 500 years ago, Eurasia has been the center of world power. But in the meantime, it is imperative that no Eurasian challenger emerges capable of dominating Eurasia and thus also challenging America. The formulation of a comprehensive and integrated Eurasian geostrategy is therefore the purpose of this book. And this is the Grand Chessboard, of course. In that context, how America manages Eurasia is critical. A power that dominates Eurasia would control two of the world's three most advanced and economically productive regions. A mere glance at the map also suggests that control over Eurasia would automatically entail Africa's subordination, rendering the Western Hemisphere and Oceania geopolitically peripheral to the world's central continent. About 75% of the world's people live in Eurasia, and most of the world's physical wealth is there as well, both in its enterprises and underneath its soil. Eurasia accounts for 3/4 of the world's known energy resources. Never before has a populist democracy attained international supremacy, but the pursuit of power is not a goal that commands popular passion, except in the conditions of a sudden threat or challenge to the public's sense of domestic well-being. The economic self-denial, that is, defense spending, and the human sacrifice, casualties even among professional soldiers, required in the effort are uncongenial to democratic instincts. Democracy is inimical to imperial mobilization. The momentum of Eurasia's economic development is already generating massive pressures for the exploration and exploitation of new sources of energy. And the Central Asian region and the Caspian Sea basin are known to contain reserves of natural gas and oil that dwarf those of Kuwait and the Gulf of Mexico and the North Sea. In the long run, global politics are bound to come increasingly uncongenial to the concentration of hegemonic power in the hands of a single state. Hence, America is not only the first, as well as the only, truly global superpower, but it is also likely to be the very last. Why? Because he's talking about the emerging world government, and it's right around the corner. And my favorite quote. Moreover, as America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues, except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. Like 9/11? Perhaps? You think? I think so. And, we're going to be heading out here in about 30 seconds. So let me just summarize a few things here. We need some money. Come to the truthlovefreedom.org website and chip in, if you will, so we can get the stuff we need to keep this going. And we'll be back next Sunday. Hopefully Justin will be back and continue on. Thank you.
I have something in my hand that I think you should own. And I'm not going to try to tell you that you don't already have it, but you, I am confident, do not have it all in one piece, like you would if you owned a copy of the Citizen's Rulebook. Do you have a copy? Oh, this is in your shirt pocket. Full force research at your fingertips, having to do with how to behave as a juror, the Constitution itself. The resources in here are just tremendous. And I'll be glad to send you a copy of this, if you'll send me enough for postage plus a dollar. Whatever you want to contribute to Truth Radio, I'll send you a copy of the Citizen's Rulebook. Just get back to me at Post Office Box 344, Nipomo, California, 93444, and it will be coming your way.